The Bible study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
This is the Ask the Pastor Hour, the second hour of the Bible study here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for joining us. Thanks again to Pastor Tom Eckstein for, I think, a very good lesson in Exodus chapter 5. It's amazing, isn't it, how if you aren't paying attention, you miss these connections to that old dusty testament, the Old Testament, thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. What could it possibly mean for us today? And then you get into something like Exodus chapter 5 and look at all the contemporary application that it has. Everything old is, as they say, new again. Joining us this morning is Chaplain Keith Wise from Lutheran Senior Services, Merrimack Bluffs location. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to be here.
Have not seen you for a while. You're looking fit and fine.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
The ministry suits you, it appears.
I'm enjoying every minute of it. Yes, indeed.
I don't know. You listened to a little bit of Exodus chapter 5. And, well, here, just sort of the basic ground rules for the Ask the Pastor program, because we're always picking up new listeners. I marvel at how many times we get an email or a call from someone who said, I was out driving around or whatever. I was playing on the internet and spinning the dial, and I found you guys on KFUO. And, boy, now that we found you, it's great to be able to listen to the kind of teaching that you get on a station like this. The study that we're going through in Exodus, like I said a moment ago, the whole idea of everything old is new again, these applications. If you're not paying attention, if you don't have the opportunity to really get into God's Word, is there a danger in being just a New Testament-only Christian? Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, the danger is you don't get the fullness of things. You don't really understand the true purpose of what Jesus came for. You don't see all that he's come and fulfilled. You don't understand the right relationship between the law and the gospel. And that doesn't mean the law is the Old Testament, the gospel is the new. There's both in both of them. But it's only half the picture. And so you're left with what would be Christianity. You know, if all we had was Romans, we would still know Christianity,
right?
But we wouldn't have it in all its wonderful fullness, and we wouldn't have all the connections to the history and understand our identity as people of God that goes all the way back, even further back than Exodus, all the way back to the beginning with Adam and Eve.
Now, you see, if you notice what I just did there, speaking of ground rules, I just threw a question out of the blue at you.
Mm-hmm.
Just popped into my head there. It went, that's what this hour is for. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727, KFUO@KFUO.org. If you want to get in by way of email, you can certainly do that. So anything that's, you know, top of mind, anything you may have seen in the news, I have some things I want to talk to Chaplain Wise about, but if you want to come in, take the conversation in a different direction, you're certainly welcome to do so. And we really enjoy hearing from you, because sometimes Chaplain Wise, where I may miss something that's going on out there, and I marvel at the fact that callers will always bring something up that, well, you don't necessarily think it applies to something like Exodus 5, and then there it is. It works out real well. Hey, I was reading the news this morning, and you know, part of the daily routine, I come in and I scan a number of different websites and news websites and Christian websites and blog sites for what's going on out there. And I came across an article that I believe I found this in the London Times, or the Times Online version of the London Daily Times. And the headline is, National Scandal is Britain's Binge Drinking Epidemic Indicative of a Deeper Social Problem. And what this goes on to say is, let me give you one of the pull quotes from the article. On the streets of Soho, most people are just too busy drinking to notice passed out partiers. The streets lined with pubs and nightclubs are just beginning to get rowdy. Men chasing each other and shrieking like teenagers. Women stumbling and falling over their too short skirts and too high heels. Soon the sidewalks are littered with empty beer bottles and reeking puddles. Anyone who's going out on a Friday night in any part of Britain's larger towns and cities will be familiar with boozed-out groups of people shouting, brawling, and causing a scene as they spill out of bars and pubs. And this is sort of, they're now lamenting this national debauch that has become the English people on any given Friday or Saturday night. And you could probably say the same for New York, San Francisco, French Quarter, Dallas.
St. Louis?
No, surely not St. Louis.
I'm sure you could find that scene not too far from here.
And as you go through the story here, what they are sort of lamenting is that there is no law any longer. Not the kind of law that you write in a book and a policeman enforces, but there's no appreciation or acceptance of the law written on the heart, that we should be self-censoring. We should somehow limit our behavior. We've become completely libertine. And I'm wondering if this is the result of divorcing any aspect of God's law from that culture, let alone our own.
Well, I think the question put there in the beginning of the article misses the point. It asks, is this a social problem? Well, no, it's not. It's a spiritual problem. Related to what you were saying, when we don't understand our identity as people of God, when we don't have any sort of hope for something bigger and better than the right now, we fall into all kinds of idolatry. And this is just one example of it. It's idolatry of self, idolatry of the party, idolatry of the now. And maybe you don't drink, but guess what? The temptation's there for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, I have to have the newest iPhone. I have to have the next iPad. I have to have the new version of the Dodge Charger. I have to have... It's all about the here and the now, and there's no bigger spiritual picture, no connection or understanding of your connection to the larger community, much less communion of saints sort of talk. So... my concern here is that, no, it's not really a social issue. That's just a symptom. The disease, if you want to talk in those terms, is that it's a spiritual issue and an idolatry issue.
And this goes to the law, God's law, as a mitigating factor in culture. Here's another quote from the story. There has been an unholy alliance between those on the left who believe that man is endowed with rights but no duties, and libertarians on the right who believe that consumer choice is the answer to all social questions. What happens when you marry these two mindsets? People will eventually believe that they have a right to do whatever they, whenever they want, because everything is merely a matter of choice. And I know you've made a few notes on this, so I'll toss the article back to you, Pastor.
Thank you.
That really is what it's come down to. It's all my choice. Choice is supreme. I will choose to. Who's God to tell me what to do? I mean, what is the... maybe a moment in the catechism might help, but what is the purpose of God's law? Is he a killjoy?
Well, unfortunately, people see it that way, but the sort of classic three uses of the law. The first is to protect us, curb bad behavior, keep bad things from happening to everybody, sort of in a universal sense of the law. The second is to show us our sin, which is where this one is really going to come into play. And the third one is to guide us into holy living, to being good people of God. So in that sort of second use of the law idea, that the law shows us our sin, sometimes it does seem like a killjoy. If, as a summary statement of the law would say, you should behave yourself and you shouldn't hurt other people and you should think of others more than yourself, kind of like Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, I don't really see perpetual binge drinking or habitual binge drinking and acting crazy in public and passing out and ending up in the hospital. That doesn't fall anywhere under there. So if that's your idea of a good time, well, maybe the law is a bit of a killjoy, but it's for your good. It's to protect you. It's to help you develop and grow as a healthy person and as a holy person. When you take God out of the picture, you run into, well, the answers that the political folks offer. Well, one side says, let the government take care of this. We have a program for that and a program for that and a program for this. And the other side says, get the government out of my life. We don't need a program for anything. Just let us decide. And what really happens is these people's lives and their souls fall through the cracks of the government apparatus. And when there's no spiritual life and no spiritual hope and no guiding from the church, they end up passed out or worse, dead on the sidewalk with nobody noticing, which is another part of the article. The rest of the people are so drunk, they don't even notice the drunk people who need help. So it's just a lack of holiness in general, which is a symptom of a lack of holiness in personal lives and a dedication to God.
Well, these people are holy. They're holy hedonistic.
Well, they're not holy in a Christian sense. Oh, let me be specific.
Oh, H-O-L-Y. Oh, yeah. I see.
They might be completely hedonistic, but they're not holy as in chosen out and being different as God's people holy.
Now, just on a personal note, and what is the attraction to this? I mean, it's one thing, once in a while in the errors of your youth to do something remarkably stupid, like drink too much. But this has become a weekly, if not more than once a night per week, event in the lives of these people as that story goes on. This is like an everyday occurrence in many cases. What's the attraction of this?
Well, not having ever been a binge drinker and not being a big drinker at all, I can't speak directly for those people, but if I was going to guess, it seems to me that there's a desire to escape. What does getting drunk do? Well, it takes you out of your reality, at least for a small amount of time. But the question then to ask these people would be, what are we escaping from? Mm. What is so bad that you have to have this to make your life, quote unquote, good? What is it about this that makes you happy? Does it make you happy? What is it about this that's attractive or more attractive than the other option of staying sober and maybe going to a movie and then hanging out with your friends and just enjoying one another's company? So there seems to be a real lack of purpose, a lack of understanding, a lack of true identity. And that's another symptom of separating yourself from God and not understanding the law, having no idea of the gospel, and then having no understanding whatsoever as being a Christian called out by God for wonderful good things in this life and even better things in the life to come.
When you talk about the negative and positive aspects of God's law, how does this thing work? The old Adam responds to inducements, but the new Adam responds to Christ? Is that how it works?
Well, I like to think of it this way. The old Adam, the person stuck in sin and likes their sin, may respond to threats. Okay?
You will burn in hell.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to burn for this. There's going to be punished for that. If you don't quit drinking, I'm going to take your car keys away and make you clean house, whatever. The new person, person with Christ, who's been given the Spirit, who's been called by God and knows they're God's child, hears that law and says, yeah, I still struggle with that, but thanks be to God, there's forgiveness for me. Thanks be to God, I have the Spirit, and the Spirit's going to lead me into good and healthy and better things because the Spirit's forming me and keeping me for something even better yet to come. It's a matter of perspective and outlook. Is there hope in the biblical sense? Is there something to look forward to besides Friday night and waking up in a puddle of my own vomit? Or is there eternity and blessedness and perfection to look forward to?
Well, I think you can judge from that article that they have determined that waking up in a puddle of their own vomit is as good as it gets.
And that's the saddest part about it. The church has plenty of work to do. If there was ever a sign that the church was needed, that the gospel, that the time is ripe for the gospel to be preached and proclaimed to people, this is it. And like we said, this isn't just a British problem. It's an American university problem. The next study will be how bad this is on our college campuses, things like that.
Right.
So the time is ripe for the preaching of the gospel, also the preaching of the law, but to help people see that there really is hope. There really is joy without these things. There really is something good and wonderful about this life that gets you ready for stuff that's even better in the next life.
But when you look at people behaving like this, when you look at people rioting in the streets, the Occupy Wall Street movement, fill in the blank, the last time the Pistons won the championship, the rioting in the streets that took place, God's law doesn't seem very effective. It doesn't seem to influence anyone these days.
Well, it does affect people, but what happens is people separate themselves from God, and God says, like you said before, foreknowledge is not the same as foreordaining. God will permit you to wander from him and go away. He doesn't desire that, but he'll permit it. So when people willingly separate themselves from God, chaos ensues.
So when you divorce culture from the first use of the law, don't be shocked when you get what you get.
Yeah, it's a recipe for disaster.
Like the article says, we have license to do whatever we want, whenever we want, however we want, to whomever we want, or
with whomever we want, yeah. Because guess what? It's all about me. I make the rules. You can't tell me what to do. I'm not hurting anybody else, which is always not true. But that's the idea about everything. We've all got rights to everything from fancy shoes to marrying whomever to everything else. It's my right. If I want to go get drunk, if I've got the money to pay for it, you can't stop me. Oh, but...
Well, when you look at the fourth commandment, you know, some people may be wondering, honoring mother and father, what does that have to do with all this sort of thing? Well, number one, your parents probably wouldn't appreciate you behaving this way, so it's a disregard of the most fundamental unit of the family, which is mother and father. But when you extrapolate that out to the greater institutions, you know, like the police and other, you know, education, whatever it may be, answer this question. What is the influence of God's law on the formation and prosecution of the civil law? What should it be?
Well, let's think in terms of Romans 13, where Paul talks about the earthly authorities being given to us by God to protect us and to help us and keep us from danger, those sorts of things. So we know that God gives us civil authority. The people in those positions are called to use that authority in godly ways for the benefit of people. And so you see in most, if not all, cultures and all civil laws, influence of the holy law. Now, the holy law itself, God's law, together with the gospel, those are particularly the realm of the church. We've got two different realms. Traditional Lutheran talk is the two kingdoms, the left and the right, the earthly and the godly, or, you know, all different kinds of categories there to name them with. But they're just two of them. You have the civil law, and then you have the holy law. Now, what we don't want to see happen is for the church to say, okay, we're going to scrap the civil law. Here's going to fix all our problems. We're just going to make this a theocratic thing, and the church is going to rule all of that. Well, that's not how God has set it up. The other thing we don't want to see is for the civil realm to say, the church, you've got it all wrong, or you're insignificant, or it doesn't matter, so we're going to take over and tell people what they can believe and what they can't and what they can worship and when they can't and how they can't. That just messes everything up. So the influence is that the church influences the civil realm by the people whom God puts in those positions. Hopefully they're in the scriptures. Hopefully they're studying and worshiping repentant, faithful people so that they strive to do what's best for everybody under their authority in the civil realm. And the civil realm then hopefully cooperates in a good way with the church, that in a way that says, you're the church, we're not, you take care of people's spiritual lives. So they're separate, but there is influence both ways.
You know, we live in the age of tearing down institutions.
Certainly.
Marriage, family. I would even go so far as to say tearing down the institution of childhood.
There is... It's very difficult to have a childhood. Heck, at our house, you know, we almost never even watch the Disney Channel, for crying out loud.
It has gotten to that point.
And the reason is, I tell my six-year-old this, the reason we don't watch this show, and I say it about almost all of them, is that the children act like mean adults, and the adults act like misbehaving children. It's all wrong. So we're not going to watch that. We're not going to do that. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. It's not good for anybody. But that's a symptom, too, of the larger society. You know, when somebody wants to influence you and they want to do it on a commercial on the television or the radio, what do? They have the children teach the adults. It happens about forest fires. It happens about cars you should buy. It happens about what kind of soap you should use. It happens about everything. And it's completely backwards. So getting back to the fourth commandment, we flipped that around. So the civil realm says that we should honor, serve, love, and obey our children at every cost and just do whatever they say. well, then they get the latest iPad, and they get the newest iPhone, and they get the newest television, and they get the best computer, and they say, oh, you want to go drink? I just want you to be happy.
Or you don't say no to inappropriate relationships.
Yeah, you don't say no, you don't encourage, and you don't guide people. And, you know, that's not to say if you're a perfect Christian, perfect parent, your children are going to turn out perfectly. We all know there are struggles and those
sure.
kind of things. But if you give up before you've started, don't be surprised with what happens in the outcome.
See, and then that goes to the point of divorcing God, divorcing Christ from the public square. And when the civil authorities fail to hold a high view of punishment, you know, we all have to understand why. You know, what's the old joke about the guy who kills his parents and then pleads for mercy because he's an orphan? You know that
yeah.
you know that old
yeah,
joke?
I hadn't heard that one, but that doesn't tend to work very well, does it?
But if God's law loses its coercive element, what then do we do to restrain evil men?
Well, that's what restrains evil. And when you divorce the spiritual realm from the civil realm by taking the church out of the public square, by not giving it a voice other than it's 1 hour on Sunday morning, which is typical for folks who go to church, then you lose that influence of godliness and holiness and right and wrong, and people can just all decide for themselves. And then you get chaos. Then you get drunkenness. Then you get murder. Then you get inappropriate relationships. Then you get people calling for homosexual marriage rights, which all those three words in a row just shouldn't exist, because there's no such thing as homosexual marriage. When you read the scriptures, it's just not there. So, not to get off on that tangent, that's been talked about a lot lately, but the basic point is that God's law is for our good and for our protection, and especially in its first use, it's meant to do just that, to keep us safe from other folks who mean us harm and from ourselves when we would harm ourselves because we don't know any better.
If you take a page from that story, if you look at the culture that is Great Britain today, this debauching, this drinking, this carrying on, this complete libertinism, license to do whatever you want, whenever you want, to whomever you want, what's the destiny of any culture that ultimately divorces God and believes nothing?
A culture that believes nothing turns into nothing sooner or later. Cultures come and go. Countries come and go. But what lasts forever? The word of the Lord lasts forever. The law of God is going to outlast the British people, unless the British people rediscover the word of God. And it's the same for any people. You know, we don't have to pick on the British. It's the same for everybody. When you don't have any grounding in the greatest reality and the greatest truth with a capital T, then eventually anything else can come and take its place. And it does.
Hmm.
And so then you just get stuff like this.
And the Lutheran perspective on the law and the way it's used, it's not just about curbing bad behavior.
No.
You know, and any man with a gun can curb bad behavior in a moment.
Yeah, if a big enough stick will do that for anybody.
But is it about replacing that bad behavior with good behavior?
Well, sure. That's where you get the what we call the third use of the law. For those who are saved by God, who know God's law, who meditate on it day and night, as Psalm 1 says, the law then is this holy thing. It's a wonderful guide for how to live the Christian life. So it's okay for pastors and Bible study teachers and those folks to say, now this is the way the Christian life looks. Does it mean you're going to be perfect at it? No, but this is what you strive for. So you strive for holiness. You strive for goodness. You strive to be out in public a good confessor of the faith, that people see you and they say, there's something different about that person. Why are you the one who's not drinking tonight? Oh, well, there's a chance for a conversation.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. Chaplain Keith Wise returns after this break. He serves at Lutheran Senior Services at Merrimack Bluffs. You'll have to tell us a little bit about LSS when we get back after these few short messages. Stick around.
Dr. C.F.W. Walther once told his seminary students, "I wish to talk the Christian doctrine into your very heart, enabling you to come forward as living witnesses with a demonstration of the Spirit and of power. I do not want you to be standing in your pulpits like lifeless statues, but to speak with confidence and cheerful courage." Today, Concordia Seminary still strives to do just that.
Hi, this is Joni Harwell. Have you ever considered becoming a KFUO Day sponsor? It's a great way to honor your loved one's birthday, confirmation, wedding anniversary, or any special event while supporting the worldwide gospel outreach of KFUO. A day sponsorship can be paid in monthly, quarterly payments, or all at one time. Would you please prayerfully consider becoming a KFUO Day sponsor? Just call me or Mary Schmidt at 1-800-844-0524. We can help you select that special day.
Good morning and welcome back to the Ask the Pastor portion of our Bible study here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. Chaplain Keith Wise, our guest, we're talking a little law and cultural decay this morning, taking as an example the story that comes out of London about the scourge of binge drinking that's not just localized to one or two places, but seems to be, as I think as the article points out, a national plague. And I bring this up in relation to the number of other stories that we've talked about where God really holds no place in the English, the British culture any longer. And before we get back to that conversation, Chaplain Wise, I think it's important because the work you do for Lutheran Senior Service is of critical importance, especially as our community, our country, continues to get grayer and grayer as the day, as I look at you.
Yeah, looking at me, how I'm getting grayer and grayer.
Now, wait a minute. Now, look at that. I don't see any frost on the roof over there.
Oh, there's a little here and there.
Yeah, but tell me about Lutheran Senior Services, Merrimack Bluffs, and how you do the work that you do.
Well, what we do, I serve as chaplain along with Deaconess Gail Truesdell. We have around 500 so residents, 300 staff there. We're the spiritual care for those people. We have regular worship services on Sundays and Wednesdays. We each do 3 Bible studies a week and devotional programs and spiritual programs. And we visit one-on-one with folks when they're healthy, when they're sick, and everything in between. And we really, really enjoy the work with the people who are there. It's been a great blessing to me to serve there. And hopefully by God's grace and His working, I'm a blessing to them as we bring the Word of God and the sacraments to them and help lead them in spiritual life.
It's watching a friend of mine go through this. It's a difficult time when children essentially have to become the parents.
Yes,
and care for those who were the caregivers to them.
It's a great struggle oftentimes, and it's a difficult transition even when everything goes well. But where we are, we have independent living apartments where folks who are completely healthy and on their own. We have the sort of in-between of assisted living and residential care. And then we have full-fledged nursing home care where folks need 24-hour help, and we do everything we can to help them, to serve their families, and to be faithful to them and our calling as Christians to love one another.
Speaking of parents and kids and the relationship between the two, how would, maybe even from the small catechism, how would Luther or how would you as a chaplain advise someone to use the law to teach someone that working hard is better than being 25, living in mom's basement, eating ho-hos and playing Xbox?
Well, you want to encourage people with their abilities. First of all, what has God given you? He's given you the ability to whatever you're talented at. Maybe you're a good writer or you're a good musician or you're great at math or whatever. So you want to encourage those abilities and those talents God has given folks when they're younger and encourage them to use them and to be willing to use them. And then when folks get older, help them see that, you know, it's not just about me getting a job and getting my own place and doing those kind of things, but it's about me serving the larger community with the gifts I have. It's a vocation thing. God has called me to this job or this position, and through this position, I get to bless other people. Now, maybe I'm putting little twist ties on bags of bread. But guess what? If none of those got put on, all the bread would be bad by the time it got to the store. Maybe I'm punching the button that sends off the rocket. Good. Because if you don't do that, the satellite's not going to go up or the astronauts are going to die. And everything in between, we all serve one another. We're all called by God to do these things, which are really acts of love and support and help for the larger community. And like I tell everybody when I do a new employee orientation at Merrimack Bluffs, I said, I don't care what department you're in, you're doing holy work. This is a godly thing you're doing, and we need you to do that. So don't ever lose sight of that, of your call from God to be who you are, because what you do in that position helps everybody, serves everybody, is an expression of God's love for all of us.
When it comes to the law, and in turn it also comes to, which is more abused these days, the law or the gospel?
I'm tempted to say yes, but I know you don't like that answer.
No, I love that answer. I just want you to expound.
I can't just say yes and then move to the next question.
Well, some who are not Lutheran
understand that. That comes from you. When you have two options, take them both. Yeah. You know, approach. The gospel gets abused when it's preached by itself. God loves you. God wants to bless you. There's nothing at all wrong with you. You're perfect. God made you this way. Doesn't matter what you do. God has saved you. Enjoy your life. It's a wonderful thing. Your house will get bigger. Your wife will get prettier. Your kids will get stronger. Your bank account will get huge. And ta-da, there's the gospel.
Yeah.
Well, when that's not balanced with the reality of everybody's life, which has suffering and difficulty and challenge and those kind of things, people don't listen to it for very long. It's not the whole story. There's no take up your cross and follow me part of that so-called gospel. The law gets abused when it is used to try to scare people into salvation. The classic example of this abuse of the law is the sort of, what is it called? At Halloween, the churches do the sort of scare you into heaven house. What's it called?
Hell house.
Yeah, hell house.
Yeah.
Which I'm always amused at, because you're not going to scare anybody into heaven. You might scare them into some outward good behavior, but the law's not going to save you. The old theological saying is the law always accuses, whether it's the first use that is meant to protect, I shouldn't have done that because it wasn't good for somebody else. The second use, which shows me my sin, it's always accusing. And the third use that says, live this way, I don't always do that. One way or the other, the law is always going to accuse. It's not going to save you. But Jesus does. So you have to keep the two of them in their right balance and the proper perspective. The gospel must predominate because Christ saves you. You didn't do anything to deserve it. You didn't do anything to get it. But even after you're saved, the law is still this holy thing that guides you to live as who God has made you to be. Ephesians 2, 8, 9, and 10. You're saved by God's grace. You didn't do anything to earn it. Now you're created for good works. That's who God made you to be. So just walk right into them. They're waiting on you. God put them there. So it's a perspective thing more than it is a which is abused more thing. I think they're both equally abused in various and sundry ways.
Well, and the problem today also is that you are speaking in very theological terms. You are giving great apps, you are really commending the veracity of Scripture in the way you talk and the way you answer the questions that I'm asking. But the problem is, most of these folks laying in the gutter in Britain or in San Francisco or in St. Louis or wherever really have no use for the Scripture, give it no thought or consideration, don't hold it in very high esteem, if any esteem at all. So then how do you argue? Do you use the law written on the heart then as a starting point, that there is this commonality among all of us about right and wrong?
Well, you can use that. I think even before you get there, when this hits the road and you have to deal with somebody who's in trouble or passed out or struggling through life, first of all, you just got to be with them and find out what it is that motivates them or doesn't motivate them. You got to learn who they are. We have to reach out as Christians and be loving towards people even when they don't seem very lovable. So you can't just go up to a bar, say in Britain this next Friday night, I wouldn't walk up and say, everybody listen, there's three uses of the law, here's what they are, now you're all fixed, go home. They're going to think I'm a lunatic.
You won't get past the first one.
and they should think I'm a lunatic, because nobody in their right mind would do that. But, you know, is there a place for a pastor, a Christian lay person to go to one of these places where that's going on and to be an example of something different? Maybe you never even get to know somebody well, but maybe you can be the one example of people having a good time without going overboard, without being crazy. Maybe you can befriend some people and just get to know them a little bit. These relationships are very important, and ultimately what you want to do with that sort of thing is get to know those people and make them see that the church is an inviting place, is a helpful place, which can maybe fill some of those gaps they're filling with alcohol right now, or whatever their idolatry is. So there's many different approaches to that, but together with what we do, say, in worship or on Sunday morning with preaching and teaching and sacraments and those kind of things, there's also got to be a lively Christianity out in the world that engages it and talks to people and is realistic about what the world looks like, too. There will be a time for those theological conversations, like right now when we're talking about details and how it works.
Sure.
But at the beginning, you just got to engage with people and get to know them some.
One of the points made in the article that I gave you is the intrusion of government into the realm of family.
Okay.
That it's trying to replace the family, that women are incentivized to block fathers, because if the father is not present, then the woman is essentially considered to be at a disadvantage, and there's all sorts of state support that comes in, and there's, well, what we would call the welfare system perhaps comes into play, that sort of thing. Can the state replace the family? Because by that article, and even some would argue in this country, it's seemingly trying to do so. You know, if you don't value abortion and gay rights and multiculturalism and global warming and, you know, continue to list on and on and on and on and on, there are those even in our government today who say you're an unfit parent. Global warming deniers should not be parents. You're poisoning the minds of your children.
Well, they go so far as to tell you what you can send in your child's lunch that you provide at home and that they eat at school.
Yeah, I forgot that story. Yeah, it's gotten that personal.
Well, and it's not just a Massachusetts story. That happens in the St. Louis area. I speak from personal experience.
Do you?
Oh, yes. You can't.
Well, stop sending those moon pies in your children's lunch and you'll be okay.
I have jokingly said I'm going to send a lunch of potato chips, marshmallows, and four cans of Coke and see if anybody has the nerve to call me. But
you know,
my daughter is on a specific diet, so we can't really do that. But, you know, the idea that the state knows better than the family in some ways comes about because families don't act like they know better to begin with.
Yeah. Well, now that's a good point.
I'm not accusing anybody on either side of this argument, but where the church has some work to do is encouraging families to be good families, to be smart families, to be the place where their people come to ask for help when they need it rather than just the government. Because let's face it, if the church was really dedicated to helping those in need, and if the church was really gangbusters after making sure people had what they needed and weren't hungry and could see a doctor if they had to and those kind of things, we wouldn't have as great a need for the government version of that sort of help that we do. So there's work there for the church to do that could lessen that perceived need from the government. Does the government overreach when there is the need that maybe the church can't? Well, sure, at times it does. So there's always going to be that tension there because of what we talked about earlier, the two different realms. So can the state go too far and try to replace the family or destroy the family? Yes, unintended, I believe. I don't think that's anybody's goal, at least I hope it's not. And can the church do more? And absolutely, because I don't think the church has willingly said, we don't want to help. But there's work on both ends of that question.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. David, good morning. You're up with Chaplain Wise. Go ahead.
Hello, Roland. I need to get some counseling here. my stepdaughter is getting married in July, and I'm paying for like the reception.
Well, and congratulations.
It's a kind of a double-edged sword.
Okay.
She has mere mentalist. She has a mentalist scent. I would say most people there won't be Christian. A lot of young people. And I'm flipping the bill for this reception, but they're going to be buying alcohol, and there's going to be a lot of people probably getting pretty plastered. Am I responsible or am I culpable for their behavior since I gave the money for them to get intoxicated? It kind of bothers my conscience, and I wanted to get some advice from you and maybe see what your views on that. And I'll just listen on the radio if I could.
No, hang on for a minute.
Okay. No, yeah, hang on for a second. Are you? You're not asking me if you're legally responsible, are you?
No.
Okay. Good.
Am I culpable if they're getting intoxicated and drunk since I paid for it?
So you worry about causing a brother to sin.
Yeah. Are you leading them into sin?
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Without knowing all the details, and I don't know all of the things, but one thing as Christians that we are called to do is respect the government. So one thing you want to be careful, especially if you're going to be in a public place, is to, if people are going to be underage, you know, that's going to have to come into play whether they drink or not. And secondly, if it's a private place and things are going to do that, you want to, as a Christian, to be careful for their safety. You want to be careful for their physical safety. You want to be careful for their spiritual safety. Now, is drinking in and of itself a sin? No. Is getting drunk because you can get drunk and then doing things that hurt yourself a sin? Yeah, I would think so, especially if you're going in with that sort of goal. So I think I can't really answer to specific people or age of people or those kind of things. But I think the bigger picture that you want to look at here is what kind of confession is this giving of my faithfulness and my Christianity? You know, I'm providing this. I want to be responsible, and I want it to do it in a holy way. And you need to ask yourself, is anything I'm doing going to lead people into sin, or could it be perceived that way? And I think you also have a parental responsibility and a privilege to say, hey, I'm paying the bill. Here's what you're getting. You know, there's a loving way to say that, you know, a longer way than just like that. But there is also that reality, too. And
let me further comment. I would prefer they would not have alcohol.
Okay.
I'm supplying her with the money, but she wants to have alcohol at the wedding reception. I would prefer not there, but she's being 24 years old.
Okay.
She's not a kid.
True.
And so I would prefer we would not have alcohol, but being a stepdad,
true,
I don't have much influence. I mean, as far as looking at me as a father figure, that much.
I understand that rule too.
Yeah.
Have you told your stepdaughter this? What you just told me?
Yeah, she's aware of it, yeah.
Okay.
But she's not really a practicing Christian. What I mean by that, you know what I mean by that. She's
I know
not
what
really,
you mean by that.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, here's what comes to mind. This is not going to be your be-all and end-all advice, okay? But just some things that I'm thinking of as we talk to one another. Don't be afraid to say to her what you just told me, and I hear that you've already done that. Don't be afraid to say it again. Don't be afraid to suggest that, hey, I will go and buy all the food. I will write the checks. I will do it myself if you feel that will release you from the responsibility of having provided alcohol for someone who shouldn't have or leads to bad things. Don't be afraid to just sit down and sort of hack this out and say, look, I know I'm your stepfather. I know I'm not your father. I want to do this for you. I love you. But I want us all to be, if not overjoyed, at least have a situation we can all live with and still enjoy the day because it's a holy, blessed, special thing. Maybe there just needs to be some more talking about what the arrangements are going to be so that you can be comfortable in your Christianity. What you end up doing and being responsible for is a good confession of your faithfulness, mm-hmm, that also encourages that even on your stepdaughter. And it's evident to everybody there without you having to pull the big authoritarian trick, you know, like, no, I'm not going to give you any money, go do it yourself, because that never works out well anyway, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know that there's a silver bullet answer for you, but there are several things to think about. And when's the wedding? How much time you got?
Oh, middle of July.
Okay, you got time to play around with how it's going to work. And one other thing we haven't mentioned yet that has to be said, I'm sure you're doing this already too, pray about this. When you're studying the scriptures, meditate on where you are and what the scriptures say and how it works. Don't just rely on Roland or me or yourself. Trust in God to help lead you and His Spirit to lead you into the truth and in wisdom to make a good decision. And then, once you've made that decision, if you're comfortable with it and it's great, wonderful. That's a wonderful blessing. If it turns out not exactly how you wanted to, tell God that too. It's going to be okay. Trust in Him to lead you to the right place.
Yeah. Yeah, because I do, and I just know there's going to be some, a lot of people that are going to abuse the alcohol, and that happens a lot at wedding receptions.
Yes, well, it does.
Yeah. I've expressed to my stepdaughter, I have one beer and then I stop. I don't drink more than one beer.
Okay.
Because I want to keep my faculties, my mind. And so I would wish they would respect that, but I don't think they will.
Well, you know, Chaplain, I'm just curious about this. The institution of marriage is established by God. That goes back to Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how two people come to be married, in many ways, is a social construct.
Yes, you know, it's a civil realm thing, how you get there.
Right, so it can be justice of the peace, or it can be the full-blown high-mass Roman Catholic
sure.
kind of wedding.
Or it could be on the boat with the captain in some places.
And, you know. And part of that social construct is the parents of the bride pay the bill. Well, it strikes me, David, that your stepdaughter believes in those social constructs because she's asking you to pay the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that is honoring father and mother, and if it's laid on your heart that you don't want to do this, perhaps the compromise is you'll take care of the wedding, but if there's going to be a bar there, it'll be a cash bar. That way, the individuals are responsible for their own actions.
Mm, very interesting, yeah.
But if she's into the social construct, if you're going to pay the bill, then she has to be part of honoring mother and father, I would think.
And that's an excellent point, Roland. You know, there is the option of having a cash bar, and then whoever buys their alcohol is responsible for how they use it.
Wow, that's good. That's good. Okay, you give me some thoughts.
All right. Well, God bless you, and blessings on the wedding, too.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to buy into these social constructs, well, play them all the way out. Why is it fair that you can say, Dad, you have to pay the bill, but I don't have to do what
but,
you say?
But here's how we're going to do that. Here's what all you're going to pay for.
And that's the child being placed over the parent again.
And in many ways it is. And I'm glad you brought that up. Being serving where I do, I don't do many weddings, so that's not one of my high points of advice there. But it is true. And I think sometimes, as parents, we have forgotten that we have a responsibility to be realistic and use our God-given authority as parents in a way that is right, even if it doesn't always make our children happy.
There you go.
Touched on this a little earlier, but I want to make sure it gets said, too. I hear a lot from folks, I just want my kids to be happy.
Hmm.
And then I shock them and say, not me. And they're like, what? I'm like, well, of course I want my children to be happy, but first I want them to be holy. Because, you know, your kid could come home with a brand new car he stole from the car dealership and a trunk full of liquor he just robbed from the liquor store and say, hey, I'm happy. Are you going to say, oh, that's all I want for you? No. You're going to do what you can to make that right before it gets really, really ugly, right? So yeah, we want our children to be happy. We want them to have good things and to enjoy their lives and be blessed by that. But we also, bringing this full round, we don't want them to do things that are harmful to themselves or dangerous, like binge drinking or stuff like that. So there's a call for us as parents, one, to know we're never going to be perfect, but two, to strive to help our children live godly lives and to use our God-given authority as parents, as Christian examples, and to guide them into holiness too, trusting that God takes care of His own children, so nurturing them in the faith, in the scriptures, in the worship, and the sacraments of the church as well.
Yeah, another point, it's one thing to assume that simply because alcohol is present at the wedding that problems will ensue. Now, that may be going to an extreme, but if David knows his daughter's friends well enough that that is a genuine concern of his, then I think you're right, Chaplain. He has an obligation to take this before his daughter and say this just wouldn't be right.
Sure, and that's not to say his daughter couldn't say, well, we'll buy the alcohol. You know, she's an adult.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, find a way to do that or to have a cash bar. There's always options. But we also, the flip side of this is, we have got, that's about the eighth flip side, but another aspect of this is also when our children are young, we let them be the adults and make the decisions, but as they get older, it seems we want them to be perpetual children and to take care of everything for them.
Yeah.
And so she's a 24-year-old woman. Let her be one and help her understand the responsibilities that come with that. And even around weddings and parties and receptions, these people are going to be adults. Expect them to be adults and do so lovingly and caringly in a godly way.
Excellent advice. Chaplain Keith Wise serves at Lutheran Senior Services Merrimack Bluffs location. If folks are sort of like my friend at a point where they're looking for someone somewhere for a loved one and having some difficulty, how do they get in touch with you?
The website is lssliving.org, and click on the Merrimack Bluffs portion, or our phone is 636-861-0600.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. God bless.
Listen, Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study Archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.
We are where you are. KFUO Radio, Clayton, St. Louis. KFUO HD, streaming live at kfuo.org.